Just want to get started here. It's my pleasure to introduce today's neuroscience seminar speaker, Dr. David Fitzpatrick from Duke University. I've known David for quite a few years now, and it's really a pleasure to have him here. David has, his work has focused on the anatomical and trying to understand the anatomical and functional organization of the visual cortex. His career has really focused on this for many years. And I have to say that I sort of draw a lot of my inspiration from his work, not only in the findings that he has continuously produced to try and emphasize plasticity in this system, but also just the quality and the style in which he approaches his questions by incorporating many techniques really to get at the basic issues that he's trying to understand. I think that recently he's been focusing more on how experience seems to be involved in driving the organization and function of the system, and I think that's the work he'll talk about today. David had actually started his training at Penn State University for his undergraduate, and then went on to do his PhD at Duke University, then did a postdoc at Medical University of South Carolina under the guidance of Jennifer Lund, then was recruited back to Duke University as an assistant professor. He rose through the ranks very quickly and is currently full professor at the at Duke's Department of Neurobiology. He was also recently named director of the Duke Institute for Brain Sciences. And I think his work has obviously been reflected in the many honors that David has received, among which are the Alfred P. Sloan Research Fellowship and the McKnight Investigator Award. David also serves on many editorial boards, including both as reviewing and senior editor at Journal of Neuroscience. So today's talk is titled Imaging Experience-Dependent Emergence of Functional Circuits in Visual Cortex. And I'll turn the microphone over to David. Welcome to the NIH.
Thank you very much, Leo, for that very generous introduction. I must say that the conversations that I was having this morning, I'm drawing inspiration from this place. I had a number of great conversations with people who are doing really exciting things. And I'm looking forward to having more of such discussions this afternoon. So what I wanted to talk to you about today is the work that we've been doing that looks at the role of experience in the development of cortical response properties. And this is just to give you an idea of the organization for the talk, a brief overview of the functional architecture of cortex and its development, to get everybody on sort of a level playing field here, and then talk about the work that we've done that indicates that there is a unique role for experience in the development of a response property known as direction selectivity in primary visual cortex. And then finally, turn to the most recent work that we've been doing, some of which was just published last December and a little bit that we haven't published yet, that looks at the rapid emergence of direction-selective responses under the influence of a motion training stimulus. Now, before I start, I just want to make the point that I, like many people here, are interested in this fundamental question of how the cerebral cortex works and how it develops. And there's no question that cerebral cortex is the crowning achievement of brain evolution. All of those things that we think of as uniquely human are a product of cortical circuits. And at the same time, it's worth emphasizing that it may be the crowning achievement, but there's more work that needs to be done to create a cortical network that functions optimally in everyone. And the list of cortical disorders of cortical function is quite long. I've just put a few of them here. But I would argue that further understanding of the basis for these disorders and treatments requires a better understanding of cortical circuits and how they develop. Now, that's obviously not a simple problem. It's quite a challenge. You get a sense for the challenge just dealing with the size of the cortex, the numbers of neurons that are present in the cortex, and the sheer number of synapses between cells in the cortex. You also get a sense for the complexity of understanding cortical circuits because of the many levels that one has to appreciate in order to understand that function. And I'll take, for example, the connectivity that exists within the subdivisions of the cerebral cortex that are involved in processing visual information. And what you see here on the left are the subdivisions of cerebral cortex defined from fMRI studies, where you can define different subdivisions of the cortex with different visual field representations, V1, V2, V3, V4, MT, etc. And on the right, you see what is by now the classic diagram for the organization or the connections between these areas. This comes from a paper by Fellman and Van Essen in cerebral cortex a number of years ago, showing you the tremendous complexity that exists in terms of the connectivity, both feed forward and feed back, between all of these areas that make up various components of the visual system. Now, if that weren't enough, one has to recognize that the boxes that exist within this figure are hiding an enormous complexity that we are just, on the verge of understanding a small amount of. And that is quite literally the circuitry that exists within a given cortical area. So, for example, this is a cross-section through visual cortex with the white matter at the top. Sorry, white matter down here and the surface at the top here. And you can see the large number of neurons that exist here. This is in a Nissl stain. But the true complexity, of course, lies at even a finer level of resolution. If you take a small bit of this cortex and blow it up, you see a diversity of cell types that exist within the cortex, myriad processes that emanate from these cell types. And if you consider the number of synapses that converge on a single pyramidal cell being the most prevalent cell type within the cortex, you're looking at between 5 and 12,000 synapses per neuron. Tremendous complexity. And ultimately, what we have to understand is not just the anatomy of the circuit, but how this circuit contributes to function, how the functional properties of these neurons are constructed from the patterns of synaptic input. Now, I would argue that visual cortex is a great model system for trying to understand the functional organization of these circuits. And certainly two of my heroes, David Hubel and Torsten Wiesel, and their pioneering studies, I think, do a great job of justifying the view that visual cortex is a wonderful model system. For those of you who are not familiar with the visual system, we start with the retina, projections from retina onto the lateral geniculate nucleus of the thalamus, and then the lateral geniculate nucleus in turn projects up into layer 4 of the cortex, and then that complex cortical network that I just showed you briefly takes that information and transforms it. Now, it was the work of Hubel and Wiesel that really showed the power of the visual cortex in allowing us to make links between structure and function. And with their electrode recordings, for example, they were able to show that individual neurons were selective for properties of the stimulus. In this case, for example, selective for the orientation of edges. And that that neurons then were essentially tuned for stimulus features such as the orientation of an edge. But beyond demonstrating this selectivity for features of the visual scene was the demonstration that there was an orderly architecture that was related to these functional properties. And they demonstrated this following the work of Vernon Mountcastle, who had had shown very nicely this, the idea of a functional column to cortical structure. They went and showed that this property orientation selectivity was distributed in a regular fashion, so that if you took a vertical microelectrode penetration, almost all the cells you encounter would have roughly the same orientation preference. And if you took a tangential penetration, oftentimes you would find an orderly progression of preferred orientations across the surface, suggesting then that orientation selectivity was mapped in a systematic fashion within the cortex. Now, subsequent techniques, notably intrinsic signal optical imaging, has made it possible to really visualize these maps. This is a work by Amiram Grinvold and Gary Blaisdell that first sort of led the way in showing how to use intrinsic signal imaging to do this. What this is basically looking at changes in light reflectance from the cortical surface that accord with patterns of activity. So what essentially we're looking at is a change in the oxy-deoxyhemoglobin ratio, something similar in a way to functional MRI, but distinct, and we can get into more detail later if you're interested in that. But basically what you're able to do is to set up an animal who's anesthetized and paralyzed and looking at a video screen, present a stimulus on the screen, for example, a horizontal grating, take an image of the cortical surface with a CCD camera, you're illuminating with red light, and look for changes in the amount of light reflection that correlate with activity. So in this, you're looking at an image here of visual cortex, and these dark regions here represent regions that are activated by the stimulus, and the light regions in between represent areas that are not activated by the stimulus. So the beauty of this technique, of course, is that you can present many stimuli and visualize how this property is mapped across the cortical surface. On the left, you see four images for different orientations. And what you can do then is create these beautiful color maps by essentially looking on a pixel-by-pixel basis at which of these orientations is most effective at modulating the reflectance from a particular spot in the map. And what you see when you do this, of course, is the fact that orientation is represented in a repeated way across the cortical surface. So, for example, regions that prefer horizontal pop up at systematic distances across the cortical surface. There are regions where there's a smooth transition between orientations, and there are regions where all orientations abut each other in so-called pinwheel formations. Now, orientation is not the only property that's distributed in a systematic fashion. It turns out that another property of cortical neurons, direction selectivity, is also represented or mapped in a columnar fashion. And so what do we mean by direction selectivity? Just to make sure everybody's on board, you'll notice that this cell responds much more vigorously to motion down and to the right than it does to motion up and to the left. And in fact, if you look at the response of this cell then to a range of different directions of motion, you'll find that it'll give rise to a really nice peak, which would be this cell's preferred direction of motion. And as I said, direction selectivity, like orientation, is also mapped, at least in some species. It is mapped very nicely both in cats and in ferrets. So here you're looking at maps of direction in a ferret visual cortex. We create these maps by presenting a stimulus, for example, a horizontal bar moving up, and then grab images of the cortical surface during that stimulation period and take a stimulus, a horizontal bar, move it down, grab images of the cortical surface, and subtract those two. And so you're looking at the difference in the response to two opposite directions of motion. And again, you can see these really nice dark spots here, which represent patches of neurons that prefer motion in the upwards direction. Just like we did for orientation, you can generate a map of direction preference, looking to see which of those directions of motion is most effective at a given location on the cortical surface. Now, what's worth pointing out is that all of these maps essentially exist or coexist within a small region of the cortex. So I told you about the map of orientation, and you see the orientation map here on the left. Now, that same region of cortex will also have an orderly representation of direction of motion, and that map will be superimposed. So, in fact, if you take a given region here, this prefers horizontal orientation, it will be subdivided into two regions that prefer opposite directions of motion. So there are systematic relationships between these different feature maps. And I haven't mentioned a map of ocular dominance, but I suspect most of you are familiar with the fact that the inputs from the two eyes are segregated at the level of the cortex into a columnar structure. That's also represented within this cortical map. So there'll be separate regions that are driven preferentially by the left and right eye, and you can imagine this whole area being tiled by these left and right eye columns. Also, some systematic relationships between those columns or those maps and maps for orientation, for example. And finally, I'm sure you're aware of the fact that there's an orderly mapping of visual space within this region. So the neurons that are sitting here will respond to a location of visual space that's offset from the location that neurons down here respond to. Now, what we've been interested in, among other things, is how are these functional maps constructed during development? There's a remarkable degree of specificity in these maps, and the question is, how does that come about? Now, all of you are undoubtedly aware of the various mechanisms that are thought to play a role in the development of cortical circuits. And in looking at this, one certainly would be thinking about molecular guidance cues and how molecular guidance cues might play a role in this. Certainly, when thinking about the mapping of visual space, molecular guidance cues are definitely playing a role in that. But there are other factors that are thought to play a role in the formation of these maps. And the one that we're focused on today would be activity-dependent synaptic plasticity. Now, the question is, what are the sources of activity that can act through these synaptic plasticity mechanisms in order to drive the emergence of these columnar structures? One of these would be endogenous patterns of activity, ongoing patterns of activity that are unrelated to stimulation in the world. These would be things like retinal waves, for example. And the other is visually driven activity, and it's visually driven activity that I really want to focus on today. And the question that we're addressing is a question that was that I heard a lot about last year. And in fact, this showed up on my coffee table, and I'm sure it spoke differently to me than it did to a lot of other people. And that's the question, how much does experience really matter? And of course, I added, in the formation of these maps. You know, when I read the subtext here, why science says it may be overrated, I took that as a challenge. And I hope that the data that I'm going to show you today will convince you that experience is playing a significant role in the development of these maps, and in particular, the development of the map of direction selectivity. Now, I want to precede this by just emphasizing that the cortex is born in, human infants are born with a cortex that is really immature. And I'll make that point here by showing you just pictures of what the dendritic morphology of cells look like in human infants from birth through 2 years of age. So just looking at the dendritic structure, it's clear that there's a tremendous amount of immaturity at birth, and that changes happen relatively rapidly. Now, if you look at the density of synapses within primary visual cortex, you'll see that there's a tremendous increase in the density of synapses after birth. Now, this is not unique to humans. So if we look at ferrets, we also see a tremendous increase in the density of synapses that occurs after birth, and in this case, after eye opening. So ferrets are born in a relatively immature state. Their eyes are closed for about a month or so, and then their eyes open. And there's a striking increase in the density of synapses in the cortex that are associated with eye opening. So in this particular plot, you're looking at postnatal age here, and the green line here represents layer 2-3 synaptic density, and you can see this tremendous increase after the time that eyes open. And you'll also notice that there are a number of other factors that change. So if you look at glutamate receptors and you look at markers for inhibitory neurons, you see tremendous increases in those that occur after eye opening. This suggests then, at the very least, that experience is on board and is in position to influence how these circuits are constructed at this early stage of development. Now, let me give you some of the background for our existing knowledge of columnar map development in ferrets, and just tell you that what we know, most of what we know, is actually from looking at ocular dominance columns. And this is showing the timeline for development in the ferret, showing you eye opening, again, roughly a month after birth. It also shows you when other events occur, such as LGN axons arriving in layer 4, when V1 becomes visually responsive, etc. But the point to take home here is that ocular dominance columns are present prior to eye opening. They strengthen as a result of experience, and they're tremendously malleable in what is known as the critical period. And so you can think of this as having, you can think of columnar map development as having two stages, a formation stage and a refinement stage, with the formation basically being laid down. You can think of it as the scaffold prior to eye opening. Now, orientation columns also seem to have a similar structure. So the basic patterning of orientation columns is certainly present at the time of eye opening, and they get stronger as a result of experience, but the map and the property itself is present when experience through open lids comes on board. Now, we wondered whether this similar pattern would apply to direction columns, and our interest in this started from the fact that direction, we thought, was distinct from orientation and ocular dominance. Both ocular dominance and orientation, in a sense, are derivatives of the topography, the spatial distribution of LGN axon arbors. Direction requires something more. It requires the correlation of both space and time to generate a receptive field that is selective for the sequence of positions of a moving stimulus. And so we wondered if this might be something that might be more sensitive to experience. And the first set of experiments led us to think that this wasn't a silly idea. What we did was just look at the natural history of the emergence of these response properties. And what you see, these are back, actually the cortices from the same animal, and this is animals of different age along this axis. You're looking at orientation on the left and direction on the right. And I think the point here is pretty clear. You see orientation from the earliest time points, and it gets stronger, but direction selectivity appears to lag behind. You begin to see a hint of it around postnatal day 37, and then it gets stronger. So there seems to be a developmental delay in the emergence of direction-selective responses. And that's illustrated over here. Again, the lines connect This is our metric. Our metric here is the standard, normalized standard deviation of the pixel values. And you see orientation getting stronger, but present prior to eye opening, but this delay in the emergence of direction selectivity that then emerges and reaches mature levels. Just because the property emerges after eye opening, of course, doesn't mean that experience is required. One has to do an experiment to test that. And so we did experiments using dark rearing, where we basically reared the animals in the dark up to these time points, brought the animal out, and asked whether direction selectivity was present. And the result, again, was very clear. Orientation was present at all time points, but direction was absent at all time points. And that's quantified over here on the right. So direction seems to be different from orientation in requiring visual experience. We made sure that this wasn't an artifact of our intrinsic signal imaging technique, so we used electrodes to record the responses of neurons in dark-reared ferrets and in normally-reared ferrets, and there was indeed a paucity of direction-selective cells in these dark-reared animals. Now, we wanted to know whether it was experience during this window of time where direction selectivity normally emerges that was critical for the emergence of direction selectivity. So we did experiments where we dark-reared through this period of time and then gave experience up to 3 weeks of experience beyond that time point. And then we compared those results with dark-rearing up to the point where direction selectivity normally emerges and then allowing experience to ensue. And the results of these experiments were also very clear. So what you see on the left is an example case, and the dots you see here, each one of those represents a different ferret that was subjected to the manipulation shown on the left. So here's the normal pattern showing the direction emergence of direction selectivity. Here's the dark-reared pattern, and again, I'm just repeating what I've already shown you. Here's the animals that were dark-reared until postnatal day 45, after the period when direction selectivity normally emerges, and then given 3 weeks of experience. And what you see is the direction selectivity fails to emerge. This is contrasted with dark-rearing just to the point where experience normally ensues, and then 3 weeks of experience, and you get normal emergence of direction selectivity. So let me sum up what I've tried to tell you. Direction columns emerge later. Visual experience is necessary for the emergence of direction selectivity, and especially experience during this window of time. And I haven't provided any data to support this last one, but I'll tell you the evidence. The requirement for early visual experience is unique to direction selectivity. So what we've done in these dark-reared animals is to go in and look at the various response properties. So, for example, spatial frequency tuning, temporal frequency tuning, contrast sensitivity, et cetera. And in the animals that were dark-reared and then given experience, all of those properties normalize except direction selectivity. So, again, it suggests that there's something unique about experience and its role in the maturation of direction selective responses. All right, so a role for visual experience, but you know exactly what is it that visual experience is supplying? Now, what you'd like to know is whether experience with a moving stimulus is what's inducing the emergence of these direction columns. I mean, it may not be. It may simply be activity that's allowing the system to percolate along and produce this columnar structure. So we designed an experiment that allowed us to test this, and we I remember talking about these experiments, and I think there was considerable skepticism about whether these experiments would work, including for me. But it sometimes pays to do the wild experiment. So what we did was take ferrets that were visually naive, they had a day or less of visual experience, set them up for imaging, and present them with what we call a motion training stimulus. So we're presenting them with a grating stimulus that's moving back and forth. Now, at the start, we're taking intrinsic signal images of the cortical surface. At the start of the experiment, what you see is what I've already told you, which is that there is a map for orientation, but there's no sign of a direction map. And now what I'm going to show you is what happens as the animal is trained with this stimulus. The stimulus was brought on in half-hour bouts, and then half-hour rest, and then another half-hour of training. The results will speak for themselves. So initially, you see nothing. And then as time progresses, gradually, you begin to see the emergence of something, a differential signal, that looks like a direction map. And in fact, if you quantify the intrinsic signal here, you see a significant increase in direction selectivity. Now, you know, one obviously wants to be careful about what this actually is. What you would like to be convinced of course, is that the pattern that's emerging here is a reflection of the stimulus that's being presented to the animal. And one way that we can evaluate this is simply by taking advantage of the fact that we've only presented one stimulus, a grating moving back and forth along one axis. At the end of the experiment, we can test all directions of motion. If the effects that we see here are related to, are due to the training stimulus, then they should only be found for the training stimulus directions. They should not be found for other directions of motion. And that is indeed what we see. So here's an experiment where we the training stimulus was a horizontal grating, moved up and down. And what you see is a direction signal for those directions of motion, but you don't see it for these other directions. And here are three other cases that show this similar specificity. So in this case, a vertical grating moved horizontally. You see the emergence of direction signal, but not for the others. These are at higher magnification. This is done through our two-photon rig, and I'll talk about those two-photon experiments in a second. But this, again, illustrates the emergence for the trained directions of motion, but not for the others. And this is just a quantification of that result in multiple ferrets, comparing the direction selectivity before and after the training, and showing a significant increase for the trained directions, but not for the orthogonal directions. So what I've shown you is that there's a relatively rapid effect of experience on the maturation of these maps. But at the end of the day, we're looking at intrinsic signal. We're looking at the average activity filtered through a hemodynamic signal. What one would like to see is whether experience is exerting an effect increasing the direction selectivity of individual cortical neurons. And so we turned to a newer technique that many of you are probably aware of. This technique has basically been adopted by a number of labs. Arthur Conneret's lab was certainly one of the first to start using this to look at the activity of large populations of single neurons in vivo. So this is two-photon in vivo imaging of calcium signals. Now, the beauty of the technique, of course, is that it allows you to see large numbers of single neurons at one time and look at changes in fluorescence, which reflect changes in calcium levels. Those calcium levels, in turn, reflect changes in spiking activity of the neurons. And this is just an example of what the morphology looks like. So in this case, we've already injected Oregon Green BAPTA into the cortex. The cells have taken up this fluorescent marker. And you can see we're going from the cortical surface, where you see all of the sort of tangential blood vessels here, down into the cortical surface. You can visualize the activity of large numbers of single neurons down to about 250 or 300 microns from the cortical surface. That may not sound like a lot, but it gives you a huge numbers of single neurons to work with. And as you know, the columnar structure goes down through the entire depth of the cortex, and we take what we see at the level of layer 2, 3 here as indicative of what's happening throughout that column. Now, that's the sort of anatomical picture of that you get of neurons with two-photon imaging. Here's the functional picture that you get. And what you're seeing here are the changes in fluorescence that are associated with two different stimuli, a rightward-facing oblique stimulus and a leftward-facing oblique stimulus. And I think if you look closely, you'll realize that neurons down here, for example, light up very nicely for the rightward-facing oblique stimulus, whereas neurons up here light up very nicely for the leftward-facing oblique stimulus. And what we can do, of course, is to present a variety of different stimuli and generate tuning curves for these neurons. And this is just showing you the time course of the response of the calcium signal to the onset of the stimulus. But for our purposes, what really counts here is the tuning functions that we can generate. So we're basically presenting eight different stimulus directions of motion, and we can quantify the delta F over F of the calcium indicator here, showing you in this particular neuron really robust response that's roughly equivalent for these two opposite directions of motion. And indeed, what's illustrated over here are neurons that the lines here represent the orientation preference of the neurons. This is from the same image that I just showed you before. You notice all of these guys up here have that leftward facing oblique orientation. The neurons down here have this rightward facing oblique orientation. Now, in addition to showing the orientation of these cells, you'll notice that there are a few arrows, these red arrows here, that are pointing in a direction. These are neurons that, in addition to being selective for orientation, exhibit direction selectivity. And we're using a threshold here to illustrate direction selectivity, and our threshold is basically 2:1, which is a common threshold used for defining neurons as direction selective. So these neurons then with the arrows are neurons that had responses where one peak was twice the height of the other. Okay? Now, you'll notice that there aren't very many of these. And this happens to be from a visually naive ferret. Now, this is just illustrating the range of direction selectivities that we see in a mature ferret and the threshold that we've used here, which is this 2:1 value. Here's our direction selective index, preferred minus opposite over preferred, and that gives us a value of a 2:1 would be a 0.5 value. But you see there's a tremendous range from having equivalent responses to having only a single peak for direction selectivity. Now, here is a comparison between an animal that's had experience for a day or less versus an animal that's had experience for 7 days. And I think this brings home the point that there's a tremendous change in the magnitude of direction selectivity that occurs during the first week of life. Now, this is not the same animal. These are different animals, but just animals that have had different amounts of visual experience. And indeed, if you take all of the animals that we've looked at that are naive and experienced, you get two very different distributions of direction selectivity. So mature animals have a significant number of cells that are beyond 0.5 or beyond this 2:1 threshold for direction selectivity. Now, what we wanted to do was to do the same experiment that we did with intrinsic signal imaging, where we were able to follow this process in a single animal over time. And so we wondered whether we would be able to follow single cells and observe changes in their direction selectivity as a result of experience. And we were able to do that. So this is an example where we picked out two cells here, and you're looking at two photon images before training and after training. And we can use landmarks, i.e. other cells, to be sure that we're looking at the same cells before and after training. And what you see in the upper left here are the tuning curves for these cells before training. And on the right, you're seeing the tuning curves for these same cells after training. And the training in this case was 6 hours, and I can talk more about the limitations of two-photon calcium imaging that prevents us from going out to 24 hours and whatnot. Basically, the dye fades, so we're limited to a narrower time window. But nevertheless, that's enough time for us to see substantial changes in the tuning properties of these neurons. So in this case, a complete loss of response to one of the directions of motion that this cell was quite responsive to prior to training. There are also other changes here that I'll point out. So you'll notice that the maximum response here after training is reduced from what you see prior to training. We're not sure what those sort of generalized changes mean on the background of a dye signal that is fading. So we're not sure how to interpret that, but we're comfortable interpreting this difference, the relative response to these two directions of motion, as representing the emergence of a selective response. This is just showing you some additional examples of before on the left and after on the right. This is an example training for 10 hours, showing you significant emergence of direction selective responses. Here's another example, before training and after training. Now, a question that's probably occurred to you is whether motion is required in order to see these effects. So an obvious experiment to do is to present the same grating stimulus, but instead of drifting that stimulus, to flash that stimulus in different phase configurations. So we stimulate the same regions of the cortex, but we just don't do it with a coherently moving stimulus. And when you do that, you see basically no change in direction selective responses. So let me use this cumulative percentage diagram to sort of sum up the results that I've shown you so far. So what this is illustrating is the cumulative percentages of direction-selective indices for cells, and 0.5, again, being this 2-to-1 threshold. And the blue line here represents what you see in experienced animals. And I would say this probably, it could underestimate the degree of direction selectivity. In our hands, at least, dye loading is much easier in younger animals, so we haven't pushed this out to animals that are a little bit older. But nevertheless, it's very different from what you see with visually naive animals. And this illustrates the impact of motion training, which, you know, can be on the order of, 6 to 10, maybe 12 hours at most, showing you a significant increase in direction selectivity. And then finally, the fact that it's the motion of the stimulus that seems to be important, so a flash stimulus doesn't give you that effect. So from what I've told you now, some of you should have a question in your mind if you were paying attention to the stimulus that I described. And the question would be, what determines the preferred direction that a neuron exhibits? So if you think about the stimulus that we're presenting, the stimulus is always moving in two directions, not simultaneously, of course, but it will move in one direction, and then it'll drift back in the opposite direction. And so if you're thinking about a neuron in the cortex trying to decide what direction of motion is going to prefer, the stimulus isn't providing you with that information, okay? Because both directions are being presented equally. So this led us to believe that that perhaps there's a weak bias that's present in the cortex, a very weak directional bias that serves as the seed for the experienced-induced emergence of direction preference. That is to say, there has to be something that breaks symmetry that allows a neuron to start building a response to one of these two directions of motion, since both of them are present in the stimulus. So we took a different tack. Instead of presenting our thresholded view of the patterns of activity in the cortex, we went with a view where we generated arrows that indicated the direction of the arrow points indicates the preferred direction of the cell, and the size of the arrow indicates the magnitude of that preference. Now, what we've also done here is to color code things so that neurons that have opposite direction preferences have different colors. Now, mind you, the differences in the peaks of these direction tuning curves for the visually naive animals are generally very small, okay? Nevertheless, we're displaying what those preferred directions are on these maps. And so what you see with the visually naive animals, of course, is the arrows are all very small. That's not surprising. And you also see that there's a tremendous mixture. So you'll have yellow cells that are sitting right next to blue cells throughout much of this field. If you look at the experienced animal, you see that it's a very different pattern. So almost all of the neurons that are sitting close to each other have the same direction preference. So we wanted to have a way of quantifying this difference between the naive animals and the experienced animals. And we came up with a local coherency index, which is basically for each cell, we looked at the number of neurons that surrounded it that had the same direction preference minus the number of neurons that had the opposite direction preference. And we did this for different sample window sizes and expressed it as a percent. So our local coherency index then can be positive 100, everyone says the same direction. It can be negative, I seem to be seeing the world differently. It can also be zero, where there's, that's interesting, but basically what this should be showing you is cells that have some pointing in the same direction, some pointing in the other direction. Actually, it does. I didn't notice that. Okay. So then what we did was to ask, what does this local coherency index look like at different distances away from a cell body? And so we're plotting the average local coherency index for the animals in our group versus distance, and this is in the experienced animals. And not surprisingly, what you see is the local coherence falls off with distance, i.e., it is a map. Now, if you look at the same measure in visually naive animals, despite the appearance here, you see that it's not zero. And in fact, there is a very weak but significant local coherence that also drops off with distance. Now, the obvious question does our motion training increase the local coherence values? And indeed, it does. So motion training leads to a striking increase in the degree of local coherency. So this leads us to the question then, does training, does experience, build on this weak local coherence that exists at the onset of training to produce a functional map. And so I want to give you an example from one case and then show you how we went about evaluating this. So this is the pattern that you see in one case prior to training, and this is the pattern that you see after training. And again, you're not surprised to see the arrows get bigger as a result of the training, but you'll also notice that some of these arrows are changing their direction, which is doubly coded here because they're changing their direction as well as their color. And I'll point out a couple of these. Here are cells that initially started out with a leftward pointing direction that as a result of the training end up pointing to the right. However, there are some cells that actually start off pointing to the right that end up, as a result of training, pointing to the left. Now, at the face of it, what might be going on here is that the training is, in a sense, providing stimulation that causes these cells to change their direction preference to become more like their neighbors. Okay? But that's not an easy thing to pull out statistically, because we're dealing with very weak signals, very weak differences in these immature animals. So we turned to a bootstrap technique that would allow us to test whether these cells are indeed changing their direction preference as a result of the training. And the bootstrap technique basically involves going back to the original data and sampling from that data and generating trials, which would include samples of 8 directions of motion, pulling them at random to create these trials, and doing that 100 times and asking in histogram form here, what direction preference do you get by sampling from that data 100 times? And if you look down here, these are examples of the bootstrap from cells after training. And you'll notice that the bootstrap is returning very prominent peaks. And what this is telling you is that based on those samples, there's a very high likelihood that this cell indeed prefers the direction, in this case, motion to the right. Now, if you look, and these are bootstraps for the same cells prior to training, you'll see up here 3 different conditions. In the first condition, when you do the bootstrapping, instead of getting 1 peak, you get 2 peaks that are almost equivalent. So basically what this is saying is, although you can assign a preference to that cell, that preference doesn't really tell you much. There's a great deal of uncertainty in that cell's preference. So we would say this cell is going from an uncertain state to a certain state as a result of the training. Here are other cells that initially actually do have a significant difference between these 2 peaks. This one, the initial state, its large peak here happens to correspond with its peak after training. So we would argue that this cell is highly likely to have stayed the same as a result of this training. And another cell is shown over here to the right, where again you get 2 peaks, but the right peak here is significantly greater than the left. And we would argue that this cell then is highly likely to have changed its direction preference as a result of the training. Now, if experience is building on this weak map that exists at the start of training, it makes a specific prediction. So the prediction is the cells that are changing or shifting, that have a high probability of changing the direction of motion, should be found in regions of the map where there's a negative local coherence. Whereas cells that are sitting, or cells that are located in regions of the map that have a high initial local coherence, should be less likely to change their direction of motion. And that's what we found. So what you're looking at here is local coherence prior to the training versus probability of angle reversal. And what you can see is the cells that are in regions of the map that have a positive local coherence have a lower probability of changing their direction of motion than cells that are sitting in regions of the map that have a negative local coherence. Now, it's important to point out that this can't be explained just in terms of noise. So we've looked at the same analysis that's been done that I just showed you in cases where we've employed flash training. We've done the same analysis in cases where we've done nothing but simply set the animal up, record, and then record again at another time. And we don't see this systematic relationship between the probability of changing direction and the local coherence of map structure. Now, let me just end with one final experiment that that we're actually just in the process of evaluating now. And it's what I've said, if you're paying attention to the issues that I've just gone through, what I've said pretty much is that it's this weak bias that exists at the start of training, which is really playing a significant role in what preference a neuron chooses, which leads to the question, does the direction of stimulus motion play a role in determining a cell's direction preference? One might imagine that regardless of the direction of stimulus motion, the very weak biases that exist in the map might be sufficient to drive the emergence of coherent structure. So to test this, what we did was we looked at unidirectional motion training. And this is an example from a case where we present one direction of motion. The training direction is shown here with the arrow. And I think if you look closely, you'll recognize that there are some changes there. And in fact, what you end up seeing is that more of the cells come to prefer the trained direction of motion. And that's illustrated here in a plot where we show the direction index before training and the direction index after training. And the trained direction of motion here is illustrated in the yellow color. And although I'm having a little bit of trouble seeing this over here, I think basically what you can see is that the majority of these cells end up above the diagonal here. And in fact, if everybody stayed the same, you'd expect this cluster of cells to be oriented along the diagonal. That's clearly not happening. It's shifted this way. And in fact, there are the blue cells here represent cells that prefer the opposite direction of motion prior to training. And you can see that many of them after training have actually shifted to prefer the direction in the training stimulus. You can also see over here that a number of the cells that preferred the training direction of motion actually increased their preference for that training direction of motion. And if we just look at the plot over here, which is showing you another measure for direction selectivity that allows us to get rid of these negative numbers here, the ratio of response to the trained direction divided by the sum of the response to both directions. This is what you see prior to training, and this is the shift towards the trained direction of motion that you see as a result of the training. So very clearly, the direction of stimulus motion is having an impact on the preference that these cells come to have as a result of the training. But if you look at this diagram, you'll also realize that not all of the cells are coming tuned to the trained direction. Now, I should emphasize that the training time window here is short, so we're looking at something on the order of 6, maybe 10 hours of training. And so I suspect with longer training, we might see more of a change. But if you look at this, you'll realize that there are a lot of blue cells that simply don't change and some that do. There are yellow cells that prefer the trained direction of motion, some of which become stronger, but others actually change to become like the opposite direction of motion. And this made us wonder whether the various responses that we're seeing here could actually be explained by this weak structure that exists at the time of training. And so we looked at that. Now, what we're looking at here is another measure, which is the probability that the cell's response matches the trained direction of motion. And here we're actually looking at the change in whether the cell's matches the trained direction of motion before and after the training. And we're looking at that relative to another measure that we call the local match coherence. And so what we're doing for these cells is we're looking at the structure of the map. So this particular portion of the map would have a lot of cells that prefer the trained direction of motion. This region of the map would have a lot of cells that prefer the opposite direction of motion. And zero here would be a region that has a mixture of cells. Now, the blue cells here are cells that, like the blue cells over here, started out preferring the direction opposite to the training stimulus. And what you can see is the change in match probability, the degree to which they become more like the training stimulus, is a function of this weak map structure. So neurons that are sitting in portions of the map that are surrounded by cells that match the trained direction of motion are more likely to change than those that are sitting in regions of the map that strongly prefer the opposite direction of motion. And likewise, we can explain the differential response of the cells that initially prefer the trained direction of motion, the fact that some get stronger for that, whereas some change to become like the opposite direction, by looking at their distribution within this weak map structure. So again, this is a difference value. So if you see it clustered around zero, it means its probability of matching the stimulus hasn't changed much. And indeed, not only does the probability not change, these are actually getting stronger for the trained direction of motion. And then those that actually flip to be like the opposite direction happen to be located in regions of the map that prefer the direction opposite to the training direction. So let me sort of sum up what I hope you've been able to glean from this. The first point is that early visual experience plays an important role in the construction of circuits that mediate direction selectivity. There is something unique about direction selectivity. There is something unique about this narrow window of time after eye opening where experience seems to be playing a significant role in the emergence of these properties. It's experience with moving visual stimuli that seems to be important. And this experience strengthens direction selectivity, and it also increases their local coherence. experience-dependent emergence of the maps exhibits properties of a self-organizing system. So what I've shown you is that experience with a bidirectional motion training stimulus is capable of driving the development of cortical circuits that represent both of those directions of motion. And while that's possible, it's also important to have balanced motion stimulation. The last bit of my talk basically demonstrated that a single direction of motion is able to bias the cells towards that direction of motion. And so we're thinking of this process of building these maps as an interaction between an initial weak bias and the properties of the stimulus. And in fact, in this last experiment, it's almost as if you're seeing those two organizing properties dueling with each other for control of what direction preference a cell exhibits. Now, I should end by thanking all of the people that are responsible for this work. Much of the work that I just described here is in the thesis of a fantastic graduate student named Ye Li. He worked together with Steve Van Hooser. Steve Van Hooser, I can't say enough about what Steve has done in the lab. Steve came to the lab when there was no two-photon imaging in the lab. In fact, it wasn't even set up. Steve is responsible for getting that entire system up and running and creating all the software for analysis of data, stimulus presentation, not to mention contributing enormously to the design of these experiments. Mark Mazurek, postdoc in the lab, contributed significantly to the analysis side of this work. And my colleague, Len White, Len is a faculty at Duke, and a fantastic colleague to work with, a person that I've been involved with for almost all of the developmental studies that have come from my lab. Maria Christensen, postdoc in the lab, working on the single direction training work, and the rest of the members of the lab. I'm sorry I didn't get to talk about their work today. Thank you for your attention. I'd be happy to answer any questions. So I would actually argue that we have. So there are two things that are going on here. Cells are going from a state where their direction preference is uncertain to becoming certain, and so that's what you're suggesting is that map is basically there and we're just strengthening it. And we would argue that there are some cells whose signal initially is strong enough to allow us to interpret that as a significant direction signal and to follow those cells over time and see whether that signal changes. Now, I probably know, at least in part, where this question is coming from. We've had an interesting series of email exchanges with Ralph, and I'm blocking on Ralph's last name, where he's been simulating these results and suggesting that just in terms of the noise in the system, et cetera, that could explain the frequency with which we see these neurons that have this apparent change in direction of motion. And while we don't argue with the simulations, what we would say is if we look at the control experiments that we've done, and those control experiments involve the flash training and the do-nothing experiments, we should be able to see the same effects in those control experiments, if it was just noise, that we see with motion training. And the point is that we don't. So we're not sure why the simulations are showing something that is inconsistent with our control experiments, and that's something that we're really interested in probing.
Yeah. Do you think it might be possible to use pharmacological manipulation to see if it's primarily excitatory or inhibitory effects that you're looking at in the brain?
Yeah. I certainly think it's possible. And I would say that at the moment we have a description of a very interesting event that's happening over a very short time span. And the question is, what are the experiments that we would be using to get at the mechanism? What aspect of the circuit is being changed by this? It could be an increase in inhibition, and certainly inhibition is immature at the time of eye opening, and inhibition increases, especially in layer 4, as a result of experience. That could be one of the factors that's driving this. It's also possible that it's a change in the organization of excitatory inputs to these cells. And in particular, we're enamored with the idea that it could be a rearrangement, if not anatomical rearrangement, a change in the efficacy of horizontal inputs to these cells that might allow for the emergence of a direction-selective response property. But pharmacological manipulations would certainly be one way to try and address this question. Structural, we're looking at the possibility of structural changes as well as well, either in terms of spine dynamics or changes in axon arbors that might be correlated with the emergence of this property.
With respect to the ferret raised in the dark for, say, 45 days, and I think you see a resistance or a time lag, at least, to training, do you think that would be reflected in, a local coherence score or something fun? I mean, I don't know what it would look like.
Stay tuned. Okay. Yes. So we have been looking at and basically trying to understand what's going on in these dark, weird animals. And one thing that you would look for is local coherence. The data has been collected, has not been analyzed yet, so I can't tell you.
Is the direction selectivity in the cortex sensitive to direction selectivity in the red?
So thank you for that question, because it's important to make the distinction between the direction selectivity that exists at the level of ganglion cells. That information is generally not thought to go through the dorsolateral geniculate nucleus and then to cortex, but rather to be important for brainstem structures that are involved in generating reflexive eye movements. Actually, there's been some nice work that's been done recently to look at direction selectivity in the retina and the degree to which it's dependent on experience. And it looks like it's very different. So direction selectivity in the retina doesn't require visual experience for its emergence. It's an interesting question. Why should the retina be able to do it, but cortex is unable to do it? I don't have an answer to that. One thing I would wonder about is that my impression is that retinal ganglion cells that are selective for direction of motion tend to have specific quadrants for their direction selectivity rather than a continuous distribution of direction selectivities. And perhaps that's something that's easier to build without experience than the smooth transitions that we see at the level of cortex. Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think I don't know what would happen in the Murugaka Tsuruta case, but the more general point that I think you're making is, do you need maps or a map-like structure to produce these response properties? And I think evolution has provided us with an answer to that question, and it's no. Rodents in particular, even rodents that see really well, like squirrels, for example, have cortical neurons that are selective for orientation. Some subset of those neurons are also selective for direction of motion. There is no map. There's no orderly mapping of those properties that we can see. Now, I think the question is, could you have local coherence in connectivity without having the kind of spatial mapping function that you see here? In other words, is the interaction function the same, but it's just cells with different properties are kind of intermixed? I would say that the jury is out on that question, but it's certainly not impossible to imagine that is the case. Certainly these experiments that, given some of the new anatomical techniques that allow you to label all of the presynaptic inputs to a given cell, if you could combine that with imaging, calcium imaging, for example, you would be able to address that kind of question. So I don't have an answer for you. I think it's a great question.
So once these maps are formed, can you change them and how fast can you change them?
Yeah. So this is where I really wish we had a genetically encodable calcium sensor that would allow us to follow these cells for a longer period of time. So,
you can start off with an animal which is already formed, and then we train with it to change.
Yeah, so we haven't tried to do that. So we haven't taken an animal that has a fully mature pattern and ask, you know, can we move it around? I think that's a good question. Leo was showing me some beautiful work that he's been doing in the olfactory system, where it seems like it doesn't matter when you do your perturbation of experience, you can get changes, plastic changes to occur. It doesn't have to be during the normal developmental window. My guess is that cortical circuits would be a lot more stable, and in fact, I think most people would argue that you certainly wouldn't see the kinds of shifts you wouldn't see these shifts in the rapid way that we've seen them during development. But we haven't tried, so I really can't answer.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you.